and freeze. Why, I'm the greatest thing since World War III, girls.
You think he's acting, but he's not. His name's Mark, thanks a lot.
My name is Mark, thanks a lot. I'm the power Sodom used on lock. I am the poor, I am the snake. I'm the beat that makes you shake. I am the killer, I am the source. And you will worship me, of course. I'm the oracle, I'm the Sith of wit. There is no question that I am it. Hey girls,
thanks a lot. Thanks a lot. You look so cool, but he's hot.
Israelite.
Wipe on my
said I was yours to receive. Choices ago. I don't want to end up like Bonnie.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
So we're once again in the middle of a climate change summit. And as is often the case during these climate change summits, we are starting to see articles outraged about the fact that many world leaders and others like Jeff Bezos flew to, in this case, it's Glasgow, Scotland, to the climate change summit on private jets. And the contrast that is illuminated by these articles is, of course, about we're trying to figure out climate change, and yet private jet on a per-person basis, outrageous carbon footprint. A private jet where you might have two pilots and a flight attendant and two people, or you know, maybe a small entourage, on a per-person basis, an outrageous expenditure of carbon emissions. And it is something that happens every time there is one of these climate summits. And it's an issue, and I'm going to talk about it. But I actually believe that it's part of the distraction from the real issue. And I'll explain to you in a moment. So here's just one sample article. Around 400 private jets carrying heads of state, billionaires, business leaders, and celebrities have converged on Glasgow for a global warming summit. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos's $65 million US dollar Gulfstream jet was among the hundreds of VIP jets reportedly carrying more than 1,000 attendees and their staff to the COP26 meeting, COP26, with others including Microsoft founder Bill Gates, actor Arnold Schwarzenegger also expected to fly in. It can't be stressed enough how bad private jets are for the environment. It is the worst way to travel by miles, says Matt Finch from the UK's Transport and Environment Campaign Group. The average private jet, and we are not talking Air Force One, emits 2 tons of CO2 every hour in flight. Private jets are very prestigious, but it is difficult to avoid the hypocrisy of using one while claiming to be fighting climate change. He said, for context, the total carbon footprint of an ordinary citizen, including everywhere they travel and everything they consume, is around 8 tons a year. So basically, like, just your flight to COP26 is 2 tons per hour. And most normal people consume, you know, about 8 tons a year in carbon emissions. In total, the 400 private aircraft are expected to emit 13,000 tons of carbon dioxide. But UK Secretary of State Liz Truss defended the number of planes flying in, saying it's important that we have people face to face. I think everybody who's ever done a Zoom call knows they're quite useful for some things. But when you really get into crunch negotiations, when you want to look somebody in the eye and talk to them face to face, you do need to meet in person. So listen, I hate to tell people the solution is not going to be to ban private jets. So let's take it piece by piece. Does this happen at every climate change summit? Yes. Do people get angry every time? Yes. Is there something legitimately hypocritical about saying we want to deal with climate, but I'm going to expend a family's worth of annual CO2 emissions just to fly myself, in this case, to Glasgow, Scotland? Yes, that's all absolutely true and legitimate. But there's two different things that are going on here. First is just a kind of like a pragmatism. The economics of private jets for these elites, for lack of a better term, dignitaries, billionaires, politicians, etc. The economics of the private jet makes sense. And it's been calculated ad nauseum. If you're a CEO and you've got to go to the airport, typically the airports you fly out of commercially are far more congested and in traffic laden areas. And you've got to get there an hour and a half before the flight, or maybe longer, depending on what's going on. And then you've got to do security boarding, all these different things, then get out of the airport. Just the additional time on the basis of what CEOs get paid, makes it worth it to do the private jet. Now, you could say, well, they shouldn't be getting paid that much. Okay, these are all debates we can have, but I want to first start from just like a completely pragmatic thing. The private jets aren't going away for these people. Private jets aren't going to be banned. I don't even know what the legal framework would be to ban private jets. Like, this stuff just isn't going to happen. We might want to do some of these things. It's not going to happen. So the solution here is not going to be to ban private jets. All right, that's number one. In terms of like the technological question here, the solution on private jet emissions is going to be renewable fuels, solar-powered planes. Prototypes already exist. At some point, it's going to be a real thing. We have to be realistic as far as that goes. I am 110% on board in saying, look at the per-person carbon emissions for getting these people to Glasgow. It's obscene. It's crazy. It's particularly counterproductive when we're talking about dealing with climate. Fine, but it's not going to change. Now, the more important thing is, for me, the private jet thing is almost as big of a distraction as saying you should recycle your orange juice containers and the boxes your Amazon stuff comes in and stop using plastic straws as a look away from the real problem issue, which is 100 companies are responsible for 71% of global emissions, and you not using plastic straws is not really going to change that. Reminder, The Guardian's been on this for 4 years. 100 companies are responsible for 71% of global emissions. A relatively small number of fossil fuel producers and their investors could hold the key to tackling climate change. Just 100 companies have been the source of more than 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions since 1988. The Carbon Majors report pinpoints how a relatively small set of fossil fuel producers may hold the key to systemic change on carbon emissions. We've known this for a very long time. Even commercial air travel accounts for only 3-4% of total U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. So here we're talking about private jets. Private jets are a smaller emitter of carbon emissions than the commercial airline industry. Commercial airliners are responsible for 3-4% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. The private jets are a fraction of that. So the finger pointing at the jets and the air travel, for me, is almost the same distraction as saying, did you just throw out that paper bag instead of recycling it or reusing it? The biggest polluters are thrilled to have articles about plastic straws. They're thrilled to have articles about people are trashing half of what they could be recycling. And they're almost as thrilled to have articles about, look at the private jets being sent to Glasgow. Are the optics bad? Of course. Of course they're bad. But the private jets aren't going away. They can eventually be shifted to renewable sources of energy. We already have the prototypes. It's going to be a while. And it is another one of these distractions from the fact that unregulated or barely regulated or not enough regulated major industry has not been told by governments, you're not going to be able to keep polluting in this way. 100 companies, 71% of global emissions. So I'm not laughing off the private jet thing, but it's important to contextualize it. Lastly, I also don't care that much about the private jets if really substantive change comes from the talks, which it rarely does. Often these talks are, we all agree very seriously, very strongly that climate change is a problem. Let's set vague, maybe achievable, completely unenforceable goals and end up putting barely a dent in the greenhouse gas emissions that we're pumping into the atmosphere. So I really wouldn't care about the private jets if we had something enforceable and more serious come out of these talks. The cycle is likely to continue. It's not actually because of the private jets. The private jets to me are more of a sign of the gap between rich and poor. Some people can't afford $400 a month for rent. And meanwhile, you have people flying to Glasgow for the climate change talks, spending $500 or $1,000 or $2,000 an hour in gas alone for the private jet. Never mind the pilots and the airport fees and all of these different things. So yes, it's absurd, but let's contextualize the absurdity. If you disagree with me, let me know. All right. I am going to deal with an issue that many people emailed me about. And I don't know if I'm going to take a position that my audience will find refreshing or if people are going to be mad at me. Some people will be mad. Joe Biden was pretty clearly falling asleep yesterday at the opening speeches of the COP26 climate change summit. He was clearly not just resting his eyes. I'm playing the video here for the audience. His head was nodding forward. There's really no doubt about it. Okay, Joe Biden was sleepy during yesterday's COP26 morning speeches. I don't think the left really gains anything from denying it and pretending that reality is not what it is. Joe Biden was tired and the speeches were pretty boring. And he's only been in Europe for a couple of days. It's, you know, 5 to 7 hours ahead of East Coast, depending on which country you're in. Your body, in the best case, adjusts 1 hour a day. So in the morning when this was going on, for Joe Biden's body clock, it was like 3 or 4 in the morning. Now, could he have had coffee? Sure, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. We don't know. I think that if we start engaging on Joe Biden wasn't really falling asleep, and it became pretty clear at one point a staffer went over and kind of started talking to him or saying something to kind of wake him up, maybe offering coffee. Joe Biden seems to kind of say no at one point. It's not clear what the conversation was, but it's pretty clear that this is what it is. If we just say it's not what's going on, we look kind of stupid. For me, the argument is, okay, so he was tired, but he's much better than the guy that he was running against, Donald Trump. Like, what exactly is the argument? I think that we need to make this issue about substance rather than just denying reality. If you start engaging and he wasn't really falling asleep, it's just kind of a dumb conversation. He was falling asleep. Okay. He was clearly falling asleep. Address it head on. Okay. Biden was falling asleep. He didn't say anything humiliating or embarrassing at this climate change summit, which Trump wouldn't even have been invited to because he said that climate change was a hoax created by China in order to hurt American manufacturing. The country of the U.S. was out of these discussions under Trump because of the things that Trump said he believed about climate change. And I can't think of any real issue on which I would rather have Trump in charge than Joe Biden, including acutely what we're talking about here when it comes to the climate. So that's my position on this. And some people might write in and say, David, you really shouldn't admit that Joe Biden was falling asleep. But that's what was going on. And I don't think we really gain anything from denying the reality. I would just and so what? I'd rather have Biden sleepy while other people are speaking than Trump there or have the U.S. not be involved at all. So let me know your thoughts on that. If I'm missing something, let me know. You can find me on Twitter at @dpacman. We're going to take a quick break and be back right after this. Remember that the David Pakman Show is primarily funded through individual memberships from viewers like you, listeners like you. I would invite you to sign up at joinpakman.com. Really appreciate every single person who does it. We do an extra show every day for our members. Sign up at joinpakman.com. Use the coupon code FELONY21 for a big discount. It's such a large discount. It should be a felony. It's not, though. And you can use the coupon code FELONY21 to sign up. Over the last few years, there's been sort of almost like a cultural battle around the FBI and intelligence agencies. The FBI, much maligned by Donald Trump and Trumpists for its allegedly politically biased involvement in electoral politics, even though if you actually think back to 2016, the FBI's involvement may have been what handed Donald Trump a victory. Remember James Comey's second completely unnecessary press conference about the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails. But let's put that aside for now. Modern day, we have seen the FBI become a flashpoint of controversy, particularly in the context of the January 6th riots. There is now a blockbuster new investigation from The Washington Post, which shows that actually the FBI received very specific tips about the violence that was expected to happen on January 6th, which did, remember, the day of the Trump riots. But the FBI, as far as The Washington Post has uncovered, declined to act. This is stunning. This is stunning. Let's look at some of the information. A sprawling new investigation by the Washington Post into the events leading up to the Capitol insurrection has revealed that the FBI received numerous and highly detailed tips on the potential for serious violence by followers of then-President Donald Trump on January 6. And despite the specificity and volume of reports, the FBI largely dismissed the warnings. The fact that law enforcement of all stripes reportedly underestimated the likelihood of violence on January 6 has already been widely reported. But the Post's massive project started last spring, based on interviews of more than 230 people, describes in excruciating detail just how much was ignored. In one of the more shocking revelations, the Post recounts how information began flooding in to the FBI as early as December 6, when the agency received a tip about a message in an online post telling Trump supporters, please be in D.C. armed on the 6th. You might have to kill the palace guards. Are you okay with that? And indeed, there was violence against the so-called palace guards, U.S. Capitol Police, there to defend the Capitol. Another message reported by the Post stated, in an apparent reference to killing officers, drop a handful, the rest will flee, meaning kill a few U.S. Capitol Police, and then they're going to get out of our way. On December 19, Trump tweeted a message exhorting his followers to come to D.C. on January 6, writing, quote, big protest in D.C. on January 6. Be there, will be wild. That lit up online pro-Trump groups, and FBI informants quickly began passing on information about highly specific planning for a violent attack in Washington. Here's how the Post puts it. The FBI received a call alerting them to Trump supporters making plans online to bring arms to Washington and arrest lawmakers. The Sunday afternoon call was handled by the Bureau's National Threat Operations Center, a clearinghouse for tips about crimes, according to a document titled Threats to Take Guns and Overrun the D.C. Police January 4 to January 20th. It's almost like the 9/11 memo. Bin Laden poised to strike. Threats to take guns and overrun D.C. police. The file was updated the following afternoon by an FBI employee seeking to reclassify the information. More domestic terrorism than criminal in nature. They wanted to say, hey, this is almost not even just criminal. This is domestic terrorism. Criminal has received a significant number of guardians as a result of threats to Congress and other government officials. The caller, according to the FBI document, said people were planning on meeting in certain areas and sneaking guns into D.C. in an attempt to overrun the D.C. police, beginning January 4th through 20th. On three different sites, there is discussion about recruitment, where to meet at, bring guns, and arresting senators and members of Congress to hold trials outside in public areas. In one specific threat, Utah Republican Senator Mitt Romney, often regarded by Trump supporters as a traitor to MAGA, was named as a target. Yet, despite all of this, on December 22nd, the Post says the FBI closed its internal threat assessment of the matter, determining it did not warrant further investigation at this time. An FBI official told the Post that before doing so, steps were taken to share the info, but ultimately, the determination was made that the tips they received featured vague and primarily First Amendment protected speech. When we think back and we say, how were they not more ready? And why was the National Guard not deployed in advance and even as the Capitol was being overrun? And as we follow the chain of command upward, we learn that on the day of, it was Donald Trump who was reportedly gleefully watching the first couple of hours of the riots, maybe thinking it would actually prevent Joe Biden from ultimately being certified as president of the United States. Later, Trump started to not really like that the rioters looked low class and made him look bad. But the pressure was building for him to deploy the National Guard. He was told Mike Pence is potentially in danger. Mike Pence had to be evacuated. They were chanting, hang Mike Pence. But we know that Trump was actually mad at Mike Pence. Trump was furious that Pence wasn't willing to do what Trump believed Pence could do to really stop the certification of Joe Biden as president, even though Pence accurately told him, I can't do that, sir, I can't do that. And the calls built for Trump to call off the protesters and to send in the National Guard. And it was Trump who resisted doing that on January 6th. But this is a much broader backstory of a sort of hot potato that was being played behind the scenes. The FBI was, at the time that they could say this is criminal, not domestic terrorism, sort of letting the DC police know you might want to do something about this. The FBI was saying to Department of Justice, you know, maybe you need to look into this and coordinate fencing or whatever the case may be. Capitol Hill police seemed not to actually even be told what the FBI was aware of. And then there was this last minute request for National Guard, which was initially resisted, although ultimately the National Guard was deployed. And there are some people who are writing, this is just like what happened on 9/11, where agencies couldn't communicate, they couldn't coordinate, there weren't systems in place. But this is actually a clearly different thing. After 9/11, systems were put in place so that different agencies could coordinate with each other. This seems more that there was a lack of willingness to do those things for reasons we don't yet totally know, and possibly because somebody ordered them to stand down. So I will now explain to you the more benign explanation and then the really horrible one. The more benign explanation here is the FBI genuinely didn't think that there was the potential for January 6th to become what it was. And they made a mistake in judgment. They didn't take it seriously enough. Now, what's interesting about that is that it would sort of run counter to the idea that the FBI and all of these intel agencies and others were out there to make Trump look as bad as possible and all these different things. It sounds like, you know, if the FBI wanted to make Trump really bad, they would have publicized this in advance. They would have made Trumpists look bad, et cetera. They didn't do that. The sort of sinister possibility for which we don't yet have evidence, right? These are the speculative ideas, is that someone, once they caught wind that the FBI was receiving these threats, information about these threats, and starting to act on them, someone told the FBI, stand down. Turn this over to someone else, sort of, but don't really give them much information because we want the riots to be able to happen because we think maybe they actually will stop the certification of the election. We don't know the answer to that yet, but every week we are getting more and more information about the fact that many people, and by people we mean elected officials, associates of Trump, and law enforcement had reason to fear that this was going to get really, really bad on January 6th, and it did. And the right preparations were not ultimately in place. At some point, we may know the full story. We still don't know it as of right now. One more January 6th story that I want to go over. It is now being reported that Republican Senator Lindsey Graham allegedly told police on January 6th about the rioters, you've got guns, use them. You've got guns, use them. Now, why would we care about this? There's actually two reasons, which I will tell you in a moment. Let's first look at a report about this that aired on CNN.
Graham, according to your report, yelled at the Senate Sergeant at Arms, what are you doing? Take back the Senate. You've got guns. Use them. The South Carolina senator was adamant. We give you guns for a reason. He repeated, use them. Another stark contrast to show how the Republican Party, you know, they've been whitewashing January 6th ever since that day. But at that time, somebody like Lindsey Graham was obviously very afraid of what was going on and was calling on law enforcement there to resort to some very extreme measures.
So there's a few really important and interesting things here. First of all, a lot of these Republicans who in retrospect claim January 6th wasn't that bad, we weren't really that much at risk, et cetera. Leaking, drip, drip, drip. We're figuring out their actions and their words both spoke to the degree of insanity that took place on that day. I'll give you an example. Congressman Mo Brooks, we found out, wore body armor that day. Why do you wear body armor unless you expect things to get really crazy? Now, Mo Brooks has since said, my wife wanted me to wear it. But why did your wife think that there was going to be violence? I mean, it's not really an explanation that takes Mo Brooks out of knowing in advance that there was a real potential for violence. That's one example. Now we have Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham, who has downplayed everything, said, listen, some people acted inappropriately, but most of what happened was constitutionally protected speech and speech alone, et cetera, et cetera. He was afraid enough that he was telling police officers to start shooting protesters. And the story that they tell in retrospect clearly doesn't match up with their actions on that day, nor does it match up with the words that are now being ascribed to them. There's a good Newsweek article about this, which says Senator Lindsey Graham reportedly called for rioters to be shot as lawmakers were forced to evacuate the Senate chamber on January 6th. The Washington Post Sunday published the results of a lengthy investigation reconstructing what happened before, during, and after the riot. The second part, titled Bloodshed, goes into detail about how then Vice President Mike Pence and members of Congress were evacuated, as we know. According to the Post, Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, was furious that senators were forced to flee their own chamber. He yelled at the sergeant at arms and urged him to shoot rioters in the mob, the newspaper reported, citing a Republican senator with knowledge of the exchange. What are you doing? Take back the Senate. You've got guns. Use them. We give you guns for a reason. Use them. Immediately after the riot, Graham turned against Donald Trump and refused to join his GOP colleagues in objecting to the certification of Biden's win. Trump and I, we've had a hell of a journey. I hate to end it this way. Oh, my God, I hate it. From my point of view, he's been a consequential president. But today, all I can say is count me out. Enough is enough. But he soon fell back in line, defending Trump as he was impeached a historic second time over the Capitol insurrection. Earlier this year, Graham insisted Trump remains the most popular Republican in the country and is essential to the GOP going forward. To try to erase Donald Trump from the Republican Party is insane, and the people who try to erase him are going to wind up getting erased. It's impossible for this party to move forward without President Trump being its leader, because the people who are conservatives have chosen him as their leader. So when we think about what happened on January 6th, and as we learn more about it and we learn about who knew what when and what were people expecting at different points in time, remember that their actions and their words on that day tell us much more than their words today. It was no big deal. These were mostly peaceful protests, etc. Lindsey Graham saying, shoot the protesters. Mo Brooks wearing body armor, etc., etc. They've been lying all along in the aftermath of January 6th. That belief, that understanding just is reinforced more and more with every passing day. We're going to take a quick break. I have so much more to cover today. For more on all of today's stories, make sure you're following us on Instagram at David Pakman Show. And you can follow me on Instagram at David.Pakman. When it comes to vaccine mandates, there are really two or three major questions. Are they legal? Are they moral? And do they work? Now, are they legal is something that in the United States is essentially settled. Now, you'll hear people say it's unconstitutional. These are the same people that say the 2020 election was unconstitutional. You ask them, well, what exactly was violated from the Constitution? They don't know. But the legality of vaccine requirements, particularly when there's a test out policy, is really without question at this point in time. Even without a test out policy for things like attending school or whatever the case may be, we've had examples of these going back more than 100 years in the United States in different places. The legality, no matter what you hear on wherever, Facebook, right-wing media, et cetera, the legality is really not in question. The morality is a different type of question. When we think about questions that we want to answer, the first thing we have is we have to determine what kind of a question it is. Is it a question with an empirical answer? How much hydrogen is there in atmospheric air that we breathe or whatever? That's one type of question. Is it wrong to steal bread to feed your family? Well, okay, that's morally, that's a judgment call. And the question of morality is more of a judgment call, and it can be debated, and it's not what we're doing today. The third question is, do vaccine mandates work? And there are many on the right who have sought to make it seem like vaccine mandates don't work by talking about the number of whatever that are threatening to quit if they have to get vaccinated, saying they will quit, writing a letter stating they will quit. And every single time that that happens, I take the position of, let's not go by what the union is threatening. Let's not go by what people are posting on social media. Let's just go by the number of people that actually quit. And we have a new data point, and it's from the New York Police Department. Despite threats and hyperbole, that up to a third of NYPD might quit over the vaccine mandate. 10,000 officers might quit. As of this morning, 34 officers have defied the vaccine mandate out of 36,000, meaning 0.09%. There is literally no effect on service at this point, says New York City Police Commissioner Dermot Shea. New York City's vaccine mandate for municipal workers has taken effect, and just 34 police officers have refused it, a far cry from the 10,000 threatened by the NYPD's union. Under the mandate announced by Mayor Bill de Blasio, all city municipal employees, including police, firefighters, and civil servants, must either get vaccinated or be put on unpaid leave. Hundreds of city workers protested the mandate, and the New York Police Department's largest union, the Police Benevolent Association, claimed it would take thousands of cops off the streets. As of Thursday morning, the PBA warned last week, there were 10,000 unvaccinated uniformed NYPD members, which equals the staffing of dozens of patrol precincts, who will be barred from reporting for duty on Monday, November 1, unless they have applied for a religious or medical exemption. The union's president, Patrick Lynch, particularly slammed Police Commissioner Dermot Shea for going along with the plan. Commissioner Shea and his team should have told the mayor this mandate and his arbitrary Friday deadline were going to throw NYPD operations into chaos. On Monday, however, the chaos failed to materialize. Less than three dozen NYPD officers were put on unpaid leave, and the department reported no interruption in service. Here is Andrew Giuliani, Rudy Giuliani's son, who's running for governor, saying 27% of NYPD may be gone. Take a look.
From police department issuing staffing, we're looking at potentially losing 27% of the NYPD at this moment. I think 73% of the NYPD has actually lost, has the vaccine.
So my position has continued to be, let's see how many of them actually do it. And the real number is 34 out of 36,000. Now, remember, what is the question we are answering? The fact that it's only 34 doesn't mean the vaccine mandate is morally right. I believe it is, but it's important that we understand what is the question we're asking. And what is the question that we are answering? The vaccine mandate is working. Now, these 34 officers, they may well find themselves looking around, wondering, what happened to my pension? What happened to my salary? What happened to my healthcare coverage? They may regret this decision, okay? But the point is, it's only 34 individuals. I also would expect that many of these 34 are mad at the rest of the 36,000 that went ahead and got vaccinated, okay? That is a really common thing in these situations where those who are the ones that are the outliers, those who are the ones that are doing what I believe is not good for their communities or their families or their jobs or for anything, they will be mad at everybody else for caving to the man and complying, etc. Also, big picture, step back and think about the numbers for a moment. 80% of U.S. adults have received at least one dose so far. 80% of U.S. adults are what we would call at least partially vaccinated right now. There's probably a bunch of lying going on about people claiming not to be vaccinated and actually being vaccinated for social pressure reasons. Anecdotally, we know this is true. We saw a very interesting report on a recent live stream of a CNN reporter who went to, I don't remember where it was, some state in the South, and re-interviewed a guy who was very much against the vaccine 6-9 months ago. And he said, I did get it, but I have not told anyone in my life because of the social pressure not to get the vaccine. I mean, mathematically, when 80% of U.S. adults have gotten at least one vaccine dose, you know that there are people who are simply lying about it. These 34 police officers in New York City, to go back to that for a moment, I got a very interesting email, which I'll read in full for you on Friday, in my mailbag. And they said, you know, we talk about the few bad apples that spoil the bunch in police departments. The 34 who refuse to get vaccinated, these might be exactly the types of officers we want gone anyway. Because we talk about the George Floyd situation or whatever the case may be. And I continue to believe, because of what I see, that most officers have the right intentions and want to do what's right. These 34 who are refusing to do what's right morally, in my opinion, might be the exact types of officers that we would want not on the force as it is. Now, again, for those who think the vaccine mandates don't work, clearly they do. We have seen health systems with about a 1% refusal rate. And it seems to be exactly the type of people we want gone who are leaving anyway, right? I mean, nurses who refuse to do what's right for patient safety are the ones who are ending up unvaccinated and quitting or getting fired from hospital systems. That's good. That's good. It sounds like a good thing not to have those folks providing care. The police officers who either don't want rules to apply to them or believe wrongly that there's something illegal about such a requirement, these are the ones that are quitting. Maybe these are the ones that we want to see quit as it is. The mandates are working really well. And whenever you hear, oh, 20% are saying or are currently unvaccinated, let's wait to see how many actually end up out of their jobs. It's a very small number, and the argument can strongly be made that these are folks we probably don't want in those jobs anyway. So Democratic Senator, ostensibly Democratic Senator Joe Manchin yesterday gave a press conference on this spending and infrastructure bill that he has been an obstacle to actually getting passed, gave a press conference yesterday that I can only describe to you as Kafkaesque. Now, what does Kafkaesque mean? Fans of the TV series Breaking Bad might recognize the word Kafkaesque. I've used it a few times before. It's really the only word I can think of to describe this, and you'll see why in a second. Kafkaesque means having a nightmarishly complex, bizarre, or illogical quality. The example that Merriam-Webster gives is that sometimes there are Kafkaesque bureaucratic delays. My birth country of Argentina, I think, is arguably best known for Kafkaesque bureaucracy problems, but that's a story for a different day. I'm going to play some clips for you from this Joe Manchin press conference. In this clip, I mean, everything is just backwards. Joe Manchin says, hey, listen, he's been working on this bill for 3 months, and he's urging the House to vote and pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Take a listen to this.
I've worked in good faith for 3 months, for the past 3 months, with President Biden, Leader Schumer, Speaker Pelosi, and my colleagues on the reconciliation bill, and I will continue to do so. For the sake of the country, I urge the House to vote and pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill.
Joe, you've been one of the primary holdups in actually getting to a bill that everybody will be happy with in terms of Democrats in the Senate. And he now is framing this as the fact that the House won't vote and pass the bill he wants to be law means he is no longer part of the problem. Think about the backwards framing. His framing is, listen, when Joe Biden wants to talk to me, I talk to him. I negotiate with Democrats. I negotiate with Republicans. And yet the House won't vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill, ignoring the fact that there's multiple components here and multiple bills, that there is a desire to pass these in tandem, and that he has been like a stubborn little kid that nobody can placate who just wants attention and is clearly enjoying the attention. But he's saying it's everybody else's fault, not mine. Next clip. Here he says he won't support any bill unless he has clarity as to the impact on inflation of that bill.
I, for one, won't support a multi-trillion dollar bill without greater clarity about why Congress chooses to ignore the serious effects of inflation and debt that have on our economy and existing government programs.
These are just the same old tired talking points. We know the effect of government programs and of government spending. Has he sought clarity on it? Has he spoken to economic experts about this? Because these answers are available. These are not things to which we can't find clarity. And now throwing in the typically Republican political football of our debt. And then in completely, you know, it's just, I don't even know what to call it, fashion. Joe Manchin says, hey, let's quit playing games and pass the bill. Yeah, Joe, You're the one playing the games.
It's time to pass the bill and quit playing games.
Irony is dead. Irony is dead. Joe Manchin says, let's stop the games and pass the bill. Now, does he recognize the absurdity of what he's saying and the fact that he's the reason that, not the only reason, one of the main reasons that we haven't yet seen a bill passed? Is he the one playing games, or is he really so naive that he sees everybody else as creating problems rather than him? Irony is dead, and this is again another reminder. In West Virginia, you either get this or you get a full-blown Republican. So the solution isn't to primary Joe Manchin. From an emotional standpoint, maybe it is. Maybe a lot of people would feel good primarying Joe Manchin if somehow someone to his left wins the primary, then they lose the general, and that seat gets flipped from Democrat to Republican. Okay, maybe some people would feel good about that because they would feel like he lost his seat. It's a punishment to him. As we talked about with Bill Scheer and with members of the audience over the last couple of weeks, the real solution is you got to flip Republican seats to Democrats. I continue to maintain that's the solution. If you disagree with me, let me know. All right, I think you're really going to like this clip, or at least be horrified by it in a sense that will be sort of enjoyable, but horrifying. We've talked about the kind of like manufactured nature of the culture wars that the right is currently engaged in. And the manufactured can mean a couple different things. Manufactured can be manufactured by creating irrational fear through lying to people and making them think that something is a threat to their way of life or to their family or whatever. So it could be manufactured with lies to create fear. It can also be considered manufactured in that it's sort of like just based on either misunderstandings or factual discrepancies, like about the 2020 election, the big lie, it's unconstitutional and states violated the rules and dead people voted. And Mike Pillow has access to voting machines that show you all these different things. And it becomes sort of a cultural thing where even though you might say, well, what's the culture of claiming the election was lost? It's this cultural fight where they see themselves as engaged in a war where it doesn't matter if they literally believe the explanations as to how the election was stolen. They see repeating that it was stolen as being on the right team and fighting this holy war of sorts, quite frankly. One of the flashpoints, so many of the flashpoints in this include critical race theory, war on Christmas, communism and socialism coming to America. You could argue the Biden dementia thing is part of the culture battle. The big lie, certainly. There's a whole list of these things, and we can go on and talk about them. Critical race theory is particularly interesting because even more in an even more pronounced way than with socialism and communism, the people talking about it don't even know what it means. Oh, all the vaccine stuff also would be another element of this. A lot of the people saying critical race theory is just a disaster, they literally have no idea what it is. They have no idea what it means. They don't understand what it means in context, out of context. They just have no clue. This is a video that has gone viral from The Good Liars, who do these really, really great interviews. The Good Liars interviewed a Virginia voter. As many of you know, today is election day in Virginia. We're going to be covering the results live of the gubernatorial race, Terry McAuliffe versus Glenn Youngkin, who's the Republican candidate. Very important race, and there are really important issues at stake. The Good Liars went and interviewed this guy, Air Force veteran, at least according to the hat the guy is wearing, and said, what's the most important issue? And the guy said, it's critical race theory. And when asked what it is, the guy literally has no idea what it is. He just doesn't know what's going on. Take a look at this.
What's the most important issue in the governor's race here in Virginia?
Getting back to the basics of teaching children, not teaching them critical race theory.
Now, before even getting to the question, what is critical race theory? It's not very small government conservative-y to want the governor to necessarily dictate school curriculum. I mean, remember, these Republicans claim to have this principle they abide by, which is you only involve government in everything when absolutely necessary. If not, you leave things, leave it to school boards, leave it to municipalities, leave it, right? But here, they want to elect Glenn Youngkin, who has made a big deal out of we got to get critical race theory out and all these different things, completely in violation of their so-called light touch conservative principles. But then here comes the question, what is critical race theory?
And what is critical race theory?
Well, I'm not going to get into the specifics of it because I don't understand it that much, but it's something that I don't, what little bit that I know, I don't care for.
And what have you heard that you don't,
well,
that you
I'm
don't
not,
like?
Well, I'm not going to, you know, I don't have that much knowledge on it, but okay. It's something that I'm not, that I don't care for.
You know, this is like when a kid is presented with, you know, broccolini for the first time, and the kid says, I don't like it, I'm not trying it. But what about it don't you like? It doesn't taste good, or you don't like the tech? I've never tried it, I don't like it, I don't want it. Okay, right, but I don't care for it. The little I know about it, which is the fact that you're trying to feed it to me, not good, I don't like it. It's a similar dynamic. Well, maybe inform yourself about what it is first. And our friend Anna Kasparian over at the Young Turks had a really good tweet about another aspect to it. So how many layers are there to this? There's a lot of layers. There's people who are just goaded into culture war issues by fear and propaganda. That's one aspect. Two, the general incompetence of the American public, which we will get to in the voicemail segment. Three is what Anna tweeted, which is, this is what manufactured culture wars meant to distract you from elites robbing this country blind results in. And folks like this guy, they would probably agree. If a Republican says corporations are robbing you blind, they would probably agree in some general sense to the extent that they understand it. If a Republican said, you know, even climate change is an issue of patriotism, like they would go for it. But very quickly, all of those substantive issues, including issues on which there aren't big differences between Republicans and Democrats who are part of the same system that is not working for tens of millions, if not more, of Americans, they get distracted with something like critical race theory, which this guy even admits that he doesn't even know what it means. So sad, funny, depressing, Kafkaesque, to go back to the earlier segment. You tell me how you would describe it. Hey, this is really interesting. We've been following this. We can call it a hypocrisy. We can call it a double standard. We can call it a contrast between the things said on Fox News about vaccine mandates and requirements and the policies of Fox News as a company. Now, most famously, Joe Biden said, hey, we need mandatory vaccine or test every week. Fox News has done something even stricter. And Fox News says, mandatory vaccine or test every day and wear masks around others if you're not vaccinated. And of course, people like Tucker Carlson and the Fox and Friends people and Jesse Waters have just said, we don't have a mandate here. It's either not true. Fox and Friends said it's a protocol, not a mandate, etc. Okay, we now have leaked information from Fox News's health and safety department as to the requirements for their upcoming annual meeting. This is just amazing, okay? 2021 Fox Annual Meeting of Stockholders Health and Safety Protocols. Look at the rules. Look at how strict this is. First of all, if you have symptoms of COVID, you got to stay home. Okay, fine. They make that clear. Health screening. The designated stockholder entrance is at particular address. Okay. Prior to admittance, you have to show your ticket to security and you've got to participate in a health screening. The health screening will have the following components. Stockholders will be asked to complete an in-person symptom screening and receive a negative test result and present verification that they are vaccinated just to go to the stockholder meeting. You got to bring proof of vaccine or acceptable proof of a negative COVID test from 24 hours prior, from within 24 hours of going to the Fox studio lot. This is much stricter than the US guidelines for coming back to the US, which say the test can be from 72 hours before. Fox says 24 hours, stricter. And or you have to disclose your vaccination status. Are any of them going to say our own company is violating HIPAA, which it's not, of course. If during the course of the health screening process, a stockholder doesn't provide verification that they are fully vaccinated or proof of a negative test, they will not be permitted entry and will not be able to attend, period. Following the health screening, stockholders will be directed to the designated lot. Okay, now look at this. On the Fox studio lot, face coverings, all stockholders must wear facial coverings while inside buildings at all times, period. On the Fox studio lot, if you do not have a facial covering, a Fox representative will provide a mask for you at no cost. Hand sanitizing. Okay, they'll have hand sanitizer. Social distancing. Facial coverings do not replace the need for physical distancing. Maintain 6 feet from others when possible. Observe social distancing directives, etc. At the annual meeting, stockholders should sit in the designated seats and wear face coverings at all times. Breaks can be taken outside in the designated area. Okay, so Fox News, for their annual meeting, has a COVID health screening for everybody. You either must be vaccinated or have a test within 24 hours, and you've got to wear a mask the entire time. And they're saying Biden's rules are authoritarian. Now, of course, the people saying that on air are not the people making these decisions. But look at that contrast. And I think these Fox hosts who continue to do this stuff and say these things, they need to continually be confronted with this. When Tucker was confronted with it, he played stupid. First, he said, I don't speak for Fox. And of course, well, you could just speak as an employee. You don't have to speak as the people who came up with the guidelines. You can just speak as someone who's subject to them. And then he said, you know, you can't force people to disclose their HIV status. And it's like, well, no, that's different than saying whether you are vaccinated. Saying whether you have a disease is different. Also, HIV is not contagious. And, you know, it went completely off the rails. It was a really great exposition of how they have no leg to stand on. It needs to keep happening. This is amazing that Fox is doing this. I agree with all of it. I mean, listen, you got a big stockholder meeting. You don't want it to be a super spreader event. It's eminently reasonable that this is what they are doing. So check out the full document. It's only like a page and a half, 2 pages for yourself. Fox COVID guidelines for their annual shareholder meeting. Okay, we've got a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. This is going to be a harsh voicemail. Yesterday, during a live stream of the first day of the Kyle Rittenhouse murder trial, I told my story of when I was on a jury. And I explained that even for the minor assault case that I was participating in the jury for, two-thirds of the jury was incompetent. They did not understand the simple instructions from the judge. They wanted to bring their own definitions of things like self-defense and assault to the jury. And my point that I made yesterday was, listen, there's a lot of incompetent people. To quote former producer Lewis, 80 to 90% of people aren't good at their jobs. And it's harsh. And a lot of people get angry because if you're, okay, I understand it. I got a voicemail that sort of plays on this idea, and it's harsh, but I don't think it's inaccurate. Take a listen.
Hey, David, it's Angie in Milwaukee. I just had to contact you after listening to your story about jury duty. First of all, I agree. The majority of people are really not competent to serve on a jury. Why I say this is because the people you described sound an awful lot like the people I work with every day. They're great, nice people, but the intelligence required to think through a guilty versus not guilty verdict and all the nuances of that, they just don't have it.
Yeah. I mean, listen, this is tough because I don't want to make fun of people, but the issue, what was at issue in the jury I served on was someone punching someone else in the face self-defense. And the judge made very clear there are rules. This was in Massachusetts at the time. There are rules for what counts as self-defense in the state. And you do have a duty to retreat. And if you could just turn around and walk away from the situation, it's not self-defense. And in the jury room, four of the six people, two just had no clue what was going on, but two insisted Now, if someone comes up to you and says something like this, you punch them in the face. That's self-defense, man. That's self-defense. And it ended up being like a 6-7 hour deliberation, which shocked the judge. It shocked the lawyers. It shocked everybody. And this was really, really simple. And so when we think about the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, and we listen to a lot of the things that were said by potential jurors and even people who made it onto the jury yesterday, I know that a lot of people like to say, it's not a perfect system, but it's the best system we have. You're judged by a jury of your peers. I'm not saying I have a better idea for how it should be done, but there's a lot of incompetent people making what are for others life and death decisions, not literally in the sense of the death penalty all the time, but going to prison for 10, 20 years, that's a life and death decision in the sense of it impacts your life for the rest of your life. And I don't know any way to put it politely, but it's a very, very scary situation we have. On today's bonus show, we're going to hear about producer Pat's road trip down to Florida, where he's going to be for the next couple months. We are going to hear about, you know, the protesters, the strikers, rather, John Deere striking employees have gotten a pretty damn good offer from John Deere. It actually seems like some of these strikes may be having positive outcomes. We'll also talk about Pennsylvania offering state employees 5 days of paid leave for getting vaccinated. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com.
Hi, this is Kristen Hirsch. You're listening to 88.3 FM. WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hi, this is Felicia Collins from Late Show with David Letterman, and you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hi, we're the Deliverance Strangers, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh, we won't respect you anymore.
WRCT Radio 900.
Hey, this is Marlon Saunders, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
This is Grant Lee Phillips telling you, if you're wondering where you're tuned to, it happens to be 88.3 FM, radio's finest. WRCT Pittsburgh.
You're tuned to WRCT Pittsburgh's automated...
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Hey, this is Jim from Rusted Root, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 in Pittsburgh. Yeah.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth. The cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a wholesome word.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Hello, this is Adam Clayton here, the bass player from U2. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
You're listening to WRCT Feedback Radio.
And your soul is next.
We don't actually have the legal documentation to back that up.
Sure.
Are
we still taping?
Yeah, sure. Go right ahead.
We're live. We're not taping.
Oh, we're live.
No,
okay.
We're taping.
We're taping. Okay. They want me to do a little promo, and what do? I say WRCT, is that it?
WRCT Pittsburgh. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Hello and speedy delivery. This is Mr. McFeely from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and I'm in Pittsburgh. I always listen to WRCT right here in Pittsburgh. Speedy delivery to you.
Hi, I'm Rob.
And I'm Mary.
From Hi.
Places.
And you're listening to WRCT
88.3 FM.
FM.
A radio.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
88.3 FM rocks.
Top dog in Pittsburgh, WRCT.
WRCT Pittsburgh. We love monkeys.
This is Ian McCulloch, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
From New York and Glasgow, this is Democracy Now!
My fellow Virginians, this is our moment.
In a shocker for Democrats, Republican Glenn Youngkin has won the Virginia gubernatorial race, while the New Jersey governor's race is too close to call. We'll get the latest. Then we go to the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow to look at the fight against big coal from South Africa to Puerto Rico with Kumi Naidu and Ruth Santiago.
We're not only denouncing and resisting this fossil fuel system. We are saying, look, let's go to the alternatives.
Plus, we speak to the leading Filipina youth climate activist, Mitzi Tan.
The Philippines is one of the most climate-vulnerable countries in the world to the climate crisis, and Standard Chartered Bank is fueling most of that destruction in our country. They are the biggest international bank that is funding the most fossil fuel companies in my country, the Philippines, which is ravaged by typhoons year after year. They've brought destruction to our doorstep, so we're here at their doorstep to demand for justice and to demand them to defund climate chaos.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In U.S. election news, Republican Glenn Youngkin has defeated Democrat and former Governor Terry McAuliffe in Virginia's closely watched gubernatorial election, which was considered a bellwether for next year's midterms. The win comes 1 year after Virginians voted for President Biden over Trump by a margin of 10%. Youngkin, former CEO of the Carlyle Group private equity firm, said he would support reinstating some abortion restrictions in Virginia, opposes teaching critical race theory in schools, and has opposed school mask and COVID vaccine mandates. Republicans have also flipped several seats in Virginia's House of Delegates and could retake control of the chamber, though final results have not yet been called. New Jersey's gubernatorial race remains too close to call, with Republican Jack Cittarelli leading incumbent Democrat Phil Murphy by around 1,000 votes, with 88% of ballots counted. But at this point, the heavily Democratic areas of Trenton and Jersey City and Newark and Princeton have not been counted. In another hotly anticipated race, community leader and socialist candidate India Walton is trailing four-term incumbent Byron Brown for mayor of Buffalo, New York. Walton beat Brown in the Democratic primary, but he responded by launching a write-in campaign in the general election. In New York City, Brooklyn Borough President, former police captain Democrat Eric Adams has become the city's second black mayor. During his campaign, he vowed to tackle crime while focusing on racial justice. Meanwhile, Pittsburgh has elected its first black mayor, Democrat Ed Gainey. In Massachusetts, 36-year-old Democrat Michelle Wu has become the first woman, first Asian American, and first person of color to be elected mayor of Boston. Wu, whose family immigrated to the United States from Taiwan, served as a Boston city councilor and is close to Senator Elizabeth Warren, who was her professor at Harvard Law School. She pledged to fight against racial inequality, gentrification, and to make transportation and housing more accessible to lower-income residents. Two U.S. House seats were up for grabs in special elections in Ohio. In the 15th congressional district, Trump-endorsed Republican Mike Kerry beat Democrat Alison Russo, who was endorsed by President Biden. Meanwhile, Democrat Chantel Brown beat Republican Laverne Gore to take the 11th district seat, left vacant by Marsha Fudge when she became the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. In Minneapolis, Mayor Jacob Frey is in the lead after the first round.